content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine. From the September 28, 2020 edition of the New Yorker, today I'll read a story about how Abraham Lincoln has been reimagined and redefined over the years. And I'll follow this by reading a speech Lincoln gave in 1838 on the perpetuation of our political institutions. Well, let's get started with Adam Gopnik's piece in the critics section of the September 28, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Better Angel, an Abraham Lincoln of His Time and Ours, by Adam Gopnik. Lincoln revisionism is not new. In the 1950s, Edmund Wilson, in these pages, shook off the crooning hagiography of Carl Sandburg's multi-volume biography and replaced it with a vision of Lincoln as a calculating, aggressive nationalist, an American Bismarck, though one in possession of a sternly arresting prose style. The Civil War, in Wilson's account, was fought for no higher cause than that which makes sea slugs attack other sea slugs, because it is in the nature of beasts to make war. In place of smiling, honest Abe, we got lynx-eyed Killer Lincoln. This view was taken up, with a few complimentary curlicues, in Gore Vidal's best-selling 1984 novel, Lincoln. Wilson and Vidal channeling the ghost of Henry Adams and seeing themselves as the last redoubts of patrician hauteur painted their Lincoln against the background of the Cold War. Lincoln's militarization of the Republic, his invention of an armed national security state, was taken to be a kind of original sin that would lead to the Pentagon and Vietnam. The lovable Lincoln persisted through this period, but Lincoln was interrogated as much as admired. And this was merely the revisionism from the left. Some Southern conservative intellectuals were still muttering, "Sic semper tyrannis." In the decades that followed, the tone of Lincoln biographies became remarkably more benign. There were hymnals in praise of Lincoln's wisdom in assembling a cabinet of political opponents, though all presidents in that era assembled cabinets of their rivals, and others on the beauty of his language. Though Disraeli in London was as good a writer, in his own way, and no one was deifying him. Spielberg's Lincoln gave us the beatified, not the Bismarckian president, even if Daniel Day-Lewis brilliantly caught the high-pitched, less-than-honeyed tones that Lincoln's contemporaries heard. In more recent years, however, Lincoln has been under assault, not for being a militarist, but for not being militant enough, for not being as thorough and egalitarian as some of the radical Republicans in Congress. Newer Lincoln biographies have been needed, and the need has been met. David S. Reynolds' Lincoln is very much an honest Abe. The title of his book, in fact, is Abe, Abraham Lincoln in His Times, published by Penguin Press. But he is an updated Abe, fully woke and finely radical. Indeed, Reynolds, the author of a first-rate biographies of Walt Whitman and John Brown, makes much of Lincoln's wonderfully named and often forgotten wide awakes, legions of young pro-Lincoln boys whose resolve and aggression far exceeded that of Bernie Sanders' army. Though Reynolds rightly recycles the metaphor of the president as a tightrope walker, we're assured that even as the walker might list left and right, his rope stretched forth in a radically progressive direction, aligned with the hot temper of our moment. Reynolds updates Lincoln by doing what scholars do now. He makes biography secondary to the cultural history of the country. Lincoln is seen as a man whose skin bears the tattoos of his time. Cultural patterns are explicated in Abe, and Lincoln is picked up and positioned against them, taking on the coloring of his surroundings rather like a taxidermied animal being placed in a reconstructed habitat in a 19th century diorama at a natural history museum. Instead of rising from one episode of strenuous self-making to another, he passes from one frame to the next, a man subsumed. So, where scholars have long known that Lincoln was plunged into a near suicidal depression by the early death in the 1830s of his first love, Anne Rutledge, Reynolds connects Lincoln's depression to a cult of sensationalism that swept the country, one that placed great prestige on acts of melodramatic emotion. In Reynolds' account, Lincoln's grief was, in part, a literary effect, or even an affectation, with Lincoln and Poe drinking from the same moody waters. This mapping of subject onto trope continues on through the last night of Lincoln's life. John Wilkes Booth's assassination of the president, President Reynolds argues, was not only an act of terrorism on behalf of the defeated South, but a kind of a method acting exercise gone significantly wrong. Extreme self-identification of actor with role was highly valued then. Junius, the patriarch of the theatrical Booth family, was famed for the hyper-intensity of his portrayals. And John, among the three Booth children who became prominent actors, most fully adopted his father's stormy style. He was pleasing Junius's ghost by enacting Brutus's killing of Caesar in real time with real weapons. Reynolds' cultural history illuminates Lincoln, and particularly his transformation from self-made lawyer into American Abe. Even readers long marinated in the Lincoln literature will find revelation in the way Abe resituates familiar episodes. Reynolds places Lincoln's early career in New Salem and Springfield, Illinois, in the 1830s, as a poor farm boy struggling to make himself into a middle-class lawyer, against the radical background of American sectarianism. We learn that free thought and free love, one favoring religious and skepticism and the other sex outside marriage, flourished on the frontier, where folks had to make up their own institutions, including a debating club that forbade any appeal to God. Lincoln participated in both movements, declaring himself a free thinker and apologizing for it in a fairly weaselly way later on when he first ran for office, and acting as an early advocate for women's right to vote and to make their own sexual choices. The young Lincoln was an enthusiastic amateur poet, and his poems are a good guide to one side of his mind, the wild, passionate side, which, Reynolds says, was a counterpart to his youthful calls for, quote, cold, calculating, unimpassioned reason, unquote. One poem defended women who'd become prostitutes. No woman ever played the whore without a man to help her, his poem quoted. Reynolds' cultural frames become more arresting as Lincoln's role grows more public. Public people are always cultural objects. Lincoln spent February 27, 1860, the day he delivered his Cooper Union speech, the speech that made him president, as he later said, at a hotel across from P.T. Barnum's museum. Reynolds reflects on Barnum and American life and how the love of weird spectacle, what we now call tabloidization of public people, was something Lincoln welcomed. He played up the comedy of his own appearance in a very Barnum-like way. His enormous body posed against his wife's petite one. Barnum's genius lay in taking circus grotesques and making them exemplary Americans. General Tom Thumb was a hero, not a freak. And so with Lincoln, as Reynolds writes, his cragged face with its cavernous eyes, large mouth and nose, and swarthy complexion, his wide ears and unruly black hair, his huge hands and feet and overly long arms and legs. These features, along with all his ill-fitting clothes and awkward gait, made him seem almost as unusual as a Barnum exhibit. When Lincoln was president, his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, compared him to a baboon, and Lincoln, asked how he could endure the insult, said, "That is no insult. It is an expression of opinion, and what troubles me most about it is that Stanton said it, and Stanton is usually right." He saw that it cost him nothing to be an American spectacle in a climate of American sensation. He even hosted a reception at the White House for Tom Thumb and his wife. Lincoln exploited photography to a similar end, beginning on that same February day when his portrait was taken at Matthew Brady's studio. Lincoln was usually pictured not as a polished neoclassical man like his political rivals, but as rough and frontier made. "Americans like a craggy guy in times of crisis." Humphrey Bogart offered a similar look to the Second World War. Even his decision to grow a beard seemed meant to evoke a log cabin hygiene that was then seen as a sign of sincerity. Lincoln knew how to use the expressive forms of his time as a frame for his mythology. Emerson and Whitman, Reynolds demonstrates, understood Lincoln better as a national figure than most journalists could. Emerson saw in him the model, self-reliant man, and Whitman, the ideal Democratic leader. As the war begins, Reynolds' lens widens in ways that are less appealingly whimsical than in the Barnum case, but still more genuinely illuminating. He explains the old puzzle of Lincoln's reluctance to fire the obstreperous and slow-moving General McClellan as a reflection of Lincoln's enthusiasm for the new technology of war. Lincoln, a backwoods man forever forward-facing, loved state-of-the-art gizmos, even urging an early machine gun upon the Union Army that it wasn't willing to use. McClellan shared Lincoln's vision of an army modernized with telegraph communications, military balloons, and railroad transportation. The choice in 1862 was not between McClellan and Grant. It was between McClellan and chaos. The culture of war itself becomes a subject in Reynolds' book. It explains the eventual turn from McClellan to Grant through a broader mid-19th century turn from elegant Napoleonic battle orchestrations to Clausewitzian frontal assaults. Sometimes, Reynolds' kind of cultural history demands more suppleness of mind than he displays. When, for instance, he proposes a parallel between Mary Lincoln locked up in the White House and Emily Dickinson isolated in her home in Amherst, we feel that we are in the presence of a similitude without a real shape. Emily was a Yankee poet of matchless genius, Mary a bewildered Southern woman in an unmanageable role. All they shared was being alone in a big house. Elsewhere, Reynolds expresses perplexity that the pro-Lincoln satirist David Locke persisted in writing sketches in the voice of Petroleum V. Nasby, his impersonation of a copperhead. An anti-Lincoln, pro-slavery northerner, quote, "Given Locke's actual affection and respect for Lincoln, it must have been very hard for him to maintain the outrageous copperhead pose," end quote. According to Reynolds. But that's like wondering why a pro-Biden comedian would keep on impersonating a MAGA-wearing Trump supporter. Sticking to the joke is what comedians do. Even with Reynolds' more compelling examples of anthropological patterns, small white caps of uncertainty may stir in the reader's mind. A man who loves the love of his life does not need cultural license to mourn, and, though Booth undoubtedly choreographed his assassination with an eye to the crowd and to his father, his brothers Junius and Edwin were committed to the manner but appalled by his deed. Actors know overacting when they see it. Throughout Abe, the terms culture and cultural recur with such hammering relentlessness, four times on a single page, and in that chapter title as well. That one wishes Reynolds' editor had given him a thesaurus. Not having enough words means not seeing enough types. Culture is a diffuse thing. Reading a book, choosing a costume, adapting a rhetorical style, transferring a code of conduct from one form to another, just laughing at a joke. Each of these forms of cultural transmission has its own vibration, its own dynamic, and its own web of associations. What counts is a sense of what counts. It's true that, as Reynolds shows in his account of sensationalism, Lincoln loved sad parlor songs. But pretty much everyone in that period loved sad songs. To make much of this is like making the possession of an email address a significant cultural token today. On the other hand, although the Shakespeare whom Lincoln loved was very much the Shakespeare beloved by 19th century America, a strenuous moralist devoted to the explication of characters in extreme emotional states, Lincoln was distinctive in turning this shared Shakespeare into a template for a new kind of oratory. The passionate phrasing and sharp summations of Lincoln's speeches, quote, the better angels of our nature, quote, of the people, by the people, for the people, end quote, are shaped by the passionate soliloquies and monosyllabic instops of Shakespeare's most agonized characters. Among Lincoln's favorite passages was Claudius's guilt-ridden, oh, my offense is rank, speech. The interpenetration of Abe and Will is real. It is important to recognize cultural set pieces, but it's also important to see that they are malleable and self-created. Lincoln made his time as much as he lived in it. That, after all, is why we're reading this book. Macro history gives us a big picture, but politics, as Hamilton reminds us, happens in hidden rooms. Readers who seek the political micro-history can turn to Sidney Blumenthal's multi-volume Lincoln biography, now in its third installment, All the Powers of the Earth, published by Simon & Schuster, with two more promised. Written by someone who bears the battle scars of modern democratic politics, the volumes are all about Lincoln as a battle-scarred democratic politician. Blumenthal, who was once a staff writer for this magazine, worked as an advisor to President Clinton and distinguished himself in the Kinstar Wars, where Lincoln's account of the most significant act in American political history, Lincoln's insurgent victory over William Seward, a senator from New York, in the Republican nomination battle of 1860, is necessarily summary, Blumenthal offers a vividly realized slow crawl across the convention floor by someone who has been there. The heroes of Blumenthal's most recent volume are the so-called Lincoln Men, a group of boosters and advisors led by David Davis and Leonard Swett, who, with a comic brio right out of Mark Twain, employed every hardball trick in the book to win Lincoln the nomination. At the Wigwam in Chicago, an immense wooden convention hall capable of holding more than 10,000 people and thrown together American style in a month, they boxed out the Seward forces, making it physically difficult for his delegates to mingle and make deals. The Lincolnians also courted a now often overlooked interest group, the emigre Germans, including many exiled by the failed liberal revolutions of 1848. As Blumenthal notes, Lincoln had bought a German language newspaper in order to appeal to those key players of the identity politics of the time. It was the equivalent of surreptitiously funding Facebook pages in 2020. The Germans refused to support anyone who was known to have a pro-nativist taint, which ruled out a lot of dog-eared veteran politicians. At the same time, the nativists spurned Seward, who, as governor of New York, had backed state subsidies for Catholic education. In the end, it all came down to a single eve-of-battle meeting in Chicago between the Lincoln Men and a group of delegates from Pennsylvania, who proposed a flat-out political swap. They'd support Lincoln in exchange for a cabinet post going to Simon Cameron, a corrupt Pennsylvania senator. David Davis agreed. Lincoln had officially warned him off such deal-making, but, as he memorably said, Lincoln ain't here. Lincoln gave Cameron the War Office, not the Department of Treasury he wanted. Davis, for his efforts, got a seat on the Supreme Court. As with Kennedy in 1960 and the Obama campaign in 2008, a macro moment met micromanagement. The background in each case was the elevation of a novice with a gift for speaking, an extraordinary personal story, and a political record too short to have incurred too many grudges. The foreground was sharp dealing, Blumenthal's kind of intricate political history, providing all the details of how the sprockets and gears engage, feeds in turn the larger cultural perspective. It's hard to grasp today the extent to which those immigrant Germans were perceived as the soul of the educated elite. In Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, it is the idealized German and perhaps Jewish Professor Bauer, with his heavy accent and love of Goethe, who rescues Joe from conventionality and joins her in building a progressive school. It may be an obvious truth, but it is still a truth worth telling. History needs both micro-political and macro-cultural perspectives. The room where it happened is part of a world where it could. Reynolds' macro history and Blumenthal's micro history coincide in their vindication of Lincoln as a profound radical. Lincoln was a single-issue candidate and a single-cause politician. The issue was slavery, and the cause was its abolition. But he was a politician, not a polemicist. He created a broad coalition and placated its parts. He was a pluralist rather than a purist. His central understanding, registered in his home base of Springfield, where, Reynolds shows, there was a lot more African-American political activism than has often been imagined, was that racist Northerners who could not be driven to equality could still be coaxed toward humanity. Abolition annealed to a broader Americanism, an understanding of equality as rooted in the sacred documents of the country. That might produce emancipation. This was an insight that Lincoln, with Machiavellian shrewdness, drove to an armed point. Lincoln was not a centrist politician who happened to find himself on the top of an erupting volcano in 1861. His election caused the eruption. As Blumenthal shows, Lincoln in his 1858 debates with the racist Senator Stephen Douglas tactically conceded points about segregation. Quote, "I do not understand that because I do not want a Negro woman for a slave, I must necessarily want her for a wife," end quote. But he was emphatic on the central point that, quote, "there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I hold that he is as much entitled to these as the white man," end quote. In a speech in Peoria, Lincoln declared about the indifference towards slavery he saw in Congress, quote, "I hate it because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself. I hate it because it deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world, and especially because it forces so many really good men amongst ourselves into an open war with the very fundamental principles of civil liberty," end quote. Reynolds, quoting this passage, remarks that Lincoln's loathing of slavery comes through as strongly here as it does in any work by the most radical abolitionist. What separated Lincoln from most other abolitionists was the absence of rhetoric that was intended to frighten as much as teach. What Reynolds calls dark reform rhetoric, or that cataloged graphically but accurately the physical horrors inflicted by slave masters. This wasn't because Lincoln did not know of these horrors. It was because he understood that moving the masses of the North to abolition could be done only by appealing to fundamental principles, reminding them that their own values were being violated, not merely another group's interests. Reynolds writes that Lincoln, aware of the risk of the kind of nihilistic bloodletting that John Brown would produce, directed this potentially anarchistic cultural current into two documents treasured by most Americans, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. By linking the fight against slavery to the extension of these documents rather than to their repudiation, he could build a truly broad anti-slavery coalition and an army brutal enough to enforce its mission. Every act of his presidency, from the gathering of the militias to the speech at Gettysburg, moved toward this end. It worked at a price. For Lincoln, the critical issue was the abolition of slavery. Racism and its constraints were, for the moment, secondary. Reynolds addresses Lincoln's supposed racism in considering colonization programs for freed slaves, noting that Martin Delaney, the most radical black activist of the time, had also championed relocating black people away from the degradations they faced here. It was a back-to-Africa sentiment, a kind of black Zionism that both Lincoln and Delaney contemplated. Similarly, Lincoln's notorious letter to the New York newspaper editor Horace Greeley, saying that if he could save the Union without freeing any slaves, he would do so, is situated as part of an ongoing joust between Lincoln and Greeley. And Reynolds says, as a way for Lincoln to garb, quote, his radical anti-slavery position in the dress of military necessity, end quote. An unexampled source on the subject of Lincoln at war, what it cost him and what he really believed, remains John Stauffer's Giants, a 2008 study of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And the best summation of Lincoln is still the oration delivered by Douglass in 1876 on the unveiling of a monument to the freed slaves. Douglass said this, "Despite the mist and haze that surrounded him, despite the tumult, the hurry, and the confusion of the hour, we were able to take a comprehensive view of Abraham Lincoln and to make reasonable allowance for the circumstances of his position. We saw him, measured him, and estimated him, not by stray utterances to injudicious and tedious delegations, who often tried his patience, not by isolated facts torn from their connection, not by any partial and imperfect glimpses caught at inopportune moments, but by a broad survey in the light of the stern logic of great events, and in view of that divinity which shapes our ends, rough-hewn them how we will, we came to the conclusion that the hour and the man of our redemption had somehow met in the person of Abraham Lincoln." Sometimes cultural works, novels, and plays can tell you more about the history of culture than cultural history can. George Sanders' universally praised novel Lincoln in the Bardo, published in 2017, creates an imagined Lincoln for our era that more literal accounts can only reinforce and echo. Saunders' novel, an oratorio of fragments sung by American ghosts huddled in a graveyard, crowding around and creepily inside Lincoln himself as he mourns his son Willie, who died in 1862, makes that death the center point of Lincoln's journey. Reynolds, in turn, reveals that spiritualism, hardcore table-rapping spiritualism, really was a presence in the Lincoln White House. The movement, as American as Mormonism, had begun in the 1840s with the Fox sisters and their pet ghost, Mr. Splitfoot, and by the 1870s had millions of adherents. Poor Mary Lincoln, after losing Willie, consulted spiritualists who claimed to commune with the dead and held seances in the White House, which her husband seems to have attended. Abe himself took seriously the political counsel he got from two leading spirit mongers, though not from their spirits. However clearly stage-managed, this cult of an accessible afterlife gave to the tragedies of the war a set of redemptive possibilities that normal religiosity couldn't quite contain, and adds to our understanding of Civil War mourning. Reynolds even includes a hair-raising and heartbreaking spirit photograph of Mary Lincoln with Abe's ghost, contrived for her years after his death. The obviousness of the fraud does not alter the pathos of the embrace, the tall man's hands placed on the small woman's shoulders, the phony and freakish treated as heroic and elegiac. These elements, the materials of Melville's The Confidence Man, are the materials of mid-19th century American culture. Lincoln's legend sits right there among them. Saunders' ghosts include those of soldiers killed in the war, reproaching the president as he mourns his own child. There is a terrible providence in the Lincolns undergoing the same kind of loss that so many less celebrated Americans had to endure. The ghost did indeed live alongside the living. Surely the belief in ghosts was in part a way of registering the mass killing of ordinary boys, and their persistence as a constant harrowing of the soul. All wars leave a hideous deficit, but the Civil War somehow left one uniquely deep. To grasp why the comedy of seance table spiritualism was not comedy at all, one must reckon with the scale of the killing. Proportionately, it is as if 8 million Americans were killed in a war now. And perhaps above all, one must reckon with the adjacency, the nearness of the places where these farm boys and working men with wives and babies were slaughtered to the places where they had lived. They died not in a foreign glade or on a distant shore, but in a hayfield across the state border. With the recent degradation of the American presidency, our four-year nightmare has provided no spectacle more nightmarish than that of Trump sitting at Lincoln's feet in his memorial for a self-pity session. It is a truism to say that we need Lincoln again. But which one? Three possible Lincolns come to mind. Call them a Barnum Lincoln, a Bardo Lincoln, and a Wigwam Lincoln. The Barnum Lincoln shows us that a vigorous thread of vulgarity ran right through Lincoln's life and public persona, and appropriately so for a Democratic leader. Though not a vulgarian himself, Lincoln saw the value of vulgarity. The sepulchral Lincoln of Daniel French's statue was not the Lincoln his contemporaries knew and loved. One of the actors in Our American Cousin, seeing the first couple arrive in their box not long before the president was killed, ad-libbed the line, "This reminds me of a story," as Mr. Lincoln says, to great and appreciative laughter. This was the Lincoln his time knew, ribald storyteller, fabulous, beloved Barnum-style freak. It is a Lincoln worth keeping in mind for those of us inclined to bemoan the debasement of our political culture. The trouble with Trump is not that he's a short-fingered vulgarian showman. The trouble is that he is only a short-fingered vulgarian showman. It is the Bardo Lincoln who radiates moral authority from his time into our own, exactly because he was one of those rare leaders who could steer directly into their complicity in death and suffering without attempting to weaken or lessen its horror. Lincoln was in intimate touch with the suffering he made happen, and he sought every day to justify it to himself and to the country. He sensed from very early on that he would never go home to Illinois. The specter of assassination was constant throughout his presidency, and his legendary dream of death in the White House is a sign that he accepted this. The British philosopher and Lincoln lover John Stuart Mill wrote soon after the president's death that there was something almost salubrious in his dying, just as the war was won. Shocking as it sounds, Mill meant that, in some almost providential way, the arc of Lincoln's life demanded his martyrdom to complete it. This Lincoln, the man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, is central to understanding the spell he continues to cast on us. If there's a Lincoln we need now, though, it must be the Wigwam Lincoln, the Paul who pretended to oppose deal-making in the boozy Chicago night, even as his ambition demanded it. That's the ghost to haunt us. Master politician, always placating one side in order to broaden a path to another, misdirecting and redirecting, building and rebuilding coalitions, all of it guided by shrewd insight into other people's foibles and needs. What really distinguished Lincoln from the other presidents who built cabinets of rivals was that, instead of struggling against them politely, he played them like a piano. He expected to lose the election of 1864 and hatched an apparent plot involving a secret letter that he demanded his cabinet sign, unseen, to get as many slaves freed as possible if he did. And then the election of 1864 was duly held in the middle of a war with millions of voters, and no one has ever had cause to question its legitimacy. Lincoln will not return from the dead, even as a ghost. But his broadly balanced, extravagantly compromised democratic pluralism may be all there is to rescue us yet again. Something has to. Soon. And now I'll read a slightly edited version of an address Lincoln gave, the Lyceum Address, on the perpetuation of our political institutions. As one of Abraham Lincoln's earliest published speeches, this address has been much scrutinized and debated by historians, who see broad implications for his later public policies. Lincoln was 20 years old at the time that he gave this speech, and he had recently moved from a struggling pioneer village to Springfield, Illinois. William Herndon, who would become Lincoln's law partner in 1844, describes the event this way. "We had a society in Springfield, which contained and commanded all the culture and talent of the place. Unlike the other one of its meetings were public, and reflected great credit on the community. The speech was brought out by the burning in St. Louis a few weeks before by a mob of a Negro. Lincoln took this incident as a sort of text for his remarks. The address was published in the Sangamon Journal and created for the young orator a reputation which soon extended beyond the limits of the locality of which he lived." And now, the perpetuation of our political institutions, an address by Abraham Lincoln before the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield, Illinois, January 27, 1838. As a subject for the remarks of the evening, the perpetuation of our political institutions is selected. In the great journal of things happening under the sun, we, the American people, find our account running under the date of the 19th century. We find ourselves in the peaceful possession of the fairest portion of the earth, as regards extent of territory, fertility of soil, and salubrity of climate. We find ourselves under the government of a system of political institutions conducing more essentially to the ends of civil and religious liberty than any of which the history of former times tells us. We then, mounting the stage of existence, found ourselves the legal inheritors of these fundamental blessings. Our duty 'tis only to transmit these to the latest generation that fate shall permit the world to know. This task of gratitude to our fathers, justice to ourselves, duty to posterity, and love for our species in general, all imperatively require us faithfully to perform. How then shall we perform it? At what point shall we expect the approach of danger? By what means shall we fortify against it? Shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? Never. all the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with all the treasure of the earth, our own excepted, in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? I answer, if it ever reach us, it must spring up amongst us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. I hope I am overwary, but if I am not, there is even now something of ill omen amongst us. I mean the increasing disregard for law which pervades the country, the growing disposition to substitute the wild and furious passions in lieu of the sober judgment of courts, and the worse than savage mobs for the executive ministers of justice. This disposition is awfully fearful in any community, and that it now exists in ours, though grating to our feelings to admit, it would be a violation of truth and an insult to our intelligence to deny. Accounts of outrages committed by mobs form the everyday news of the times. They have pervaded the country from New England to Louisiana. They are neither peculiar to the eternal snows of the former nor the burning suns of the latter. They are not the creature of climate. Neither are they confined to the slaveholding or the non-slaveholding states. Alike, they spring up among the pleasure-hunting masters of southern slaves and the order-loving citizens of the land of steady habits. Whatever, then, their cause may be, it is common to the whole country. It would be tedious, as well as useless, to recount the horrors of all of them. Those happening in the state of Mississippi and at St. Louis are, perhaps, the most dangerous in example and revolting to humanity. In the Mississippi case, they first commenced by hanging the regular gamblers. A set of men, certainly not following for a livelihood a very useful or very honest occupation, but one which, so far from being forbidden by the laws, was actually licensed by an act of the legislature, passed but a single year before. Next, Negroes suspected of conspiring to raise an insurrection were caught up and hanged in all parts of the state. And then white men, supposed to be leagued with the Negroes, and finally strangers from neighboring states, going thither on business, were in many instances subjected to the same fate. Thus went on this process of hanging, from gamblers to Negroes, from Negroes to white citizens, and from these to strangers, till dead men were seen literally dangling from the boughs of trees upon every roadside, and in numbers almost sufficient to rival the native Spanish moss of the country as a drapery of the forest. Turn, then, to that horror-striking scene at St. Louis. A single victim was only sacrificed there. His story is very short and is perhaps the most highly tragic, if anything of its length, that has ever been witnessed in real life. A mulatto man by the name of McIntosh was seized in the street, dragged to the suburbs of the city, chained to a tree, and actually burned to death. And all within a single hour from the time he had been a free man, attending to his own business and at peace with the world. Such are the effects of mob law, and such as the scenes, becoming more and more frequent in this land, so lately famed for love of law and order, and the stories of which have even now grown too familiar to attract anything more than an idle remark. But you are, perhaps, ready to ask, what has this to do with the perpetuation of our political institutions? When men take it in their heads today to hang gamblers or burn murderers, they should recollect that in the confusion usually attending such transactions, they will be as likely to hang or burn someone who is neither a gambler nor a murderer as one who is. And that, acting upon the example they set, the mob of tomorrow may, and probably will, hang or burn some of them by the very same mistake. Thus, by the operation of this mobocratic spirit, which all must admit is now abroad in the land, the strongest bulwark of any government, and particularly of those constituted like ours, may effectually be broken down and destroyed. I mean the attachment of the people. By such things, the feelings of the best citizens will become more or less alienated from it, and thus it will be left without friends, or with too few, and those few too weak, to make their friendship effectual. At such a time, and under such circumstances, men of sufficient talent and ambition will not be wanting to seize the opportunity, strike the blow, and overturn that fair fabric which for the last half century has been the fondest hope of the lovers of freedom throughout the world. I know the American people are much attached to their government. I know they would suffer much for its sake. I know they would endure evils long and patiently before they would ever think of exchanging it for another. Yet, notwithstanding all this, if the laws be continually despised and disregarded, if their rights to be secure in their persons and property are held by no better tenure than the caprice of a mob, the alienation of their affections from the government is the natural consequence, and to that, sooner or later, it must come. Here, then, is one point at which danger may be expected. The question recurs, how shall we fortify against it? The answer is simple. Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his posterity, swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate in the least particular the laws of the country, and never to tolerate their violation by others. As the patriots of 76 did to the support of the Declaration of Independence, so to the support of the Constitution and laws, let every American pledge his life, his property, and his sacred honor. Let every man remember that to violate the law is to trample on the blood of his father and to tear the character of his own and his children's liberty. When I so pressingly urge a strict observance of all the laws, let me not be understood as saying there are no bad laws, nor that grievances may not arise, for the redress of which no legal provisions have been made. I mean to say no such thing. But I do mean to say that although bad laws, if they exist, should be repealed as soon as possible, still, while they continue in force, for the sake of example, they should be religiously observed. So also in unprovided cases, if such arise, let proper legal provisions be made for them with the least possible delay. But till then, let them, if not too intolerable, be borne with. But it may be asked, why suppose danger to our political institutions? Have we not preserved them for more than 50 years? And why may we not for 50 times as long? We hope there is no sufficient reason. We hope all dangers may be overcome. But to conclude that no danger may ever arise would itself be extremely dangerous. There are now, and will hereafter be, many causes, dangerous in their tendency, which have not existed heretofore, and which are not too insignificant to merit attention. That our government should have been maintained in its original form from its establishment until now, is not much to be wondered at. It had many props to support it through that period, which now are decayed and crumbled away. Through that period, it was felt by all to be an undecided experiment. Now, it is understood to be a successful one. Then, all that sought celebrity and fame and distinction expected to find them in the success of that experiment. Their all was staked upon it. Their destiny was inseparably linked with it. Their ambition aspired to display before an admiring world a practical demonstration of the truth of a proposition which had hitherto been considered, at best, no better than problematical, namely, the capability of a people to govern themselves. If they succeeded, they were to be immortalized, their names were to be transferred to counties and cities and rivers and mountains, and to be revered and sung and toasted through all time. If they failed, they were to be called knaves and fools and fanatics for a fleeting hour, then to sink and be forgotten. They succeeded. The experiment is successful, and thousands have won their deathless names in making it so. But the game is caught. And I believe it is true that with the catching end the pleasures of the chase. This field of glory is harvested, and the crop is already appropriated. But new reapers will arise, and they, too, will seek a field. It is to deny what the history of the world tells us is true, to suppose that men of ambition and talents will not continue to spring up amongst us. And when they do, they will as naturally seek the gratification of their ruling passion as others have so done before them. The question, then, is, can that gratification be found in supporting and maintaining an edifice that has been erected by others? Most certainly it cannot. Many great and good men sufficiently qualified for any task they should undertake may ever be found, whose ambition would inspire to nothing beyond a seat in Congress, a gubernatorial or a presidential chair. But such belong not to the family of the lion or the tribe of the eagle. What? Think you these places would satisfy an Alexander, a Caesar, or a Napoleon? Never. Towering genius disdains a beaten path. It seeks regions hitherto unexplored. It sees no distinction in adding story to story upon the monuments of fame, erected to the memory of others. It denies that it is glory enough to serve under any chief. It scorns to tread in the footsteps of any predecessor, however illustrious. It thirsts and burns for distinction. And if possible, it will have it. Is it unreasonable then to expect that some man possessed of the loftiest genius, coupled with ambition sufficient to push it to its utmost stretch, will at some time spring up among us? And when such a one does, it will require the people to be united with each other, attached to the government and laws, and generally intelligent to successfully frustrate his designs. Here, then, is a probable case, highly dangerous, and such a one as could not have well existed heretofore. Another reason which once was, but which to the same extent is now no more, has done much in maintaining our institutions thus far. I mean the powerful influence which the interesting scenes of the Revolution had upon the passions of the people, as distinguished from their judgment. By this influence, the jealousy, envy, and avarice incident to our nature, and so common to a state of peace and prosperity and conscious strength, were, for the time, in a great measure smothered and rendered inactive, while the deep-rooted principles of hate and the powerful motive of revenge, instead of being turned against each other, were directed exclusively against the British nation, and thus, from the force of circumstances, the basest principles of our nature were either made to lie dormant or to become the active agents in the advancement of the noblest cause, that of establishing and maintaining civil and religious liberty. But this state of feeling must fade, is fading, has fading, with the circumstances that produced it. Those circumstances were the pillars of the temple of liberty, and now that they have crumbled away, that temple must fall, unless we, their descendants, supply their places with other pillars, hewn from the solid quarry of sober reason. Passion has helped us, but can do so no more. It will be in future our enemy. reason, cold, calculating, unimpassioned reason, must furnish all the materials for our future support and defense. Let those materials be molded into general intelligence, sound morality, and in particular a reverence for the Constitution and laws, and that we improved to the last, that we remained free to the last, that we revered his name to the last, that during his long sleep we permitted no hostile foot to pass over or desecrate his resting place, shall be that which to learn the last trump shall awaken our Washington. Upon these let the proud fabric of freedom rest, as the rock of its basis, and as truly as has been said of the only greater institution, the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. This was the speech given by Abraham Lincoln in 1838 at the Lyceum in Springfield, Illinois, entitled The Preparation of Our Political Institutions. It has been edited slightly for length to fit this broadcast. Well, we have some time for a cartoon. In the first cartoon, there's a couple sitting in their living room, man sitting down watching TV, pointing the remote control at the TV, woman standing up, holding a cup of coffee. The man says to her, "Now that I can watch whatever I want, whenever I want, my life has no structure." In the final cartoon, we see a house that is completely destroyed by a huge grand piano on top of it. Couple outside looking at it. One of them says to the other, "The piano's in tune, but the house is a little flat." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Would love to hear from you. Your comments and opinions on the broadcast are very important. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.